It's Monday, October 7, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Even though much of our federal government is shut down, the United States Supreme Court is not, and this week it begins its new year. And as many have already observed, this year could be a big one in terms of precedent-setting decisions handed down by the High Court, or then again, it might not. That particular situation is explained well by Paul Clement. He is a frequent lawyer appearing before the court, and as he told the Washington Post, this could be a huge year because the court has huge issues coming before it. But then again, it might not, because the court has an off-ramp on virtually every one of these cases. As the Associated Press reported yesterday, the Supreme Court is beginning a new term with controversial issues that offer the court's conservative majority the chance to move aggressively to undo limits on campaign contributions, undermine claims of discrimination in housing and mortgage lending, and allow for more government-sanctioned prayer. Now, when you look at that lead in that Associated Press report, it's pretty clear that there's a good deal of editorializing going on there. The very words that are used there, such as undermining claims of discrimination. But nevertheless, the article does cover the waterfront in terms of why this could be a huge year for the court. The Associated Press quotes a law professor at Georgetown University. That's Professor Pamela Harris, who had previously served in President Obama's Justice Department. She said, and I quote, "There are an unusual number of cases going right to hot-button cultural issues and aggressive briefing on the conservative side asking precedents to be overruled," end quote. That last phrase, quoted from Professor Harris, indicates that conservative lawyers have been at work bringing cases before the court. This means they've been working those cases at the district level and then at the appellate level, and finally now they have arrived at the Supreme Court. That's something many Americans simply don't understand. It takes a long time, generally speaking, for issues to appear before the Supreme Court. For instance, it's been almost 2 years since we've been talking about the Obama administration's contraceptive mandate. That case is not yet before the court, but as observers are well aware, it could be on the court's docket this very year. That indicates another truth about the court. It hasn't decided all the cases it's going to decide. Over the course of the next several weeks, the court will have to decide whether or not it is going to grant what is known as a writ of certiorari. That is, a statement that it's going to receive a case and is going to hear it during this term. One of the reasons why there are so many people watching the court this term is that it is likely there will be an abortion case, the first since 2007 before the court, and that case is going to be a review of an Oklahoma law that would restrict the use of certain abortion-inducing drugs, including RU486. The issue of affirmative action is coming back before the court again, and it's coming back because the court simply didn't say enough in the last decision. It's one of those prickly, very difficult issues the court has tried to finesse. And now it's paying the price by having the issue come back again. And it's going to come back again and again and again until the court actually rules on it in a clear and consistent way. But then again, on the issue of prayer, the court has a track record of being very confused, if not confusing. And now, as a case challenging prayer at government meetings comes along, yet another one, the court is confronted with an opportunity either to clarify or to confuse. And at this point, we have no way of knowing which way the court will go. There's something else that watchers of the court are very much aware of, and that is that at least 4 of the 9 justices are now over the age of 75. Not one of them has indicated any plan for retirement. Yesterday's cover story in the Washington Post magazine had a photograph on the front of Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the oldest of the justices. And the magazine was asking the question, when will she make the biggest decision she's going to make as a judge? And that is when to retire from a life appointment. One thing that becomes more clear as you watch the court over time, as a president gets to the end of his second term, justices appear to be less likely to retire, more likely to wait and see how the next election turns out. Because at least in this sense, the Supreme Court is carefully watching the elections. Yesterday's edition of the New York Times had a huge story of worldview significance. Ian Levitt wrote the story. The headline is, "Abortion Vote Exposes Rift at a Catholic University." The story comes from Los Angeles, and the center of it is Loyola Marymount University, a very beautiful campus overlooking the Los Angeles West Side, and there a fight over abortion is threatening, as the New York Times says, to rip the school asunder. Here's how Levitt describes the situation. Trustees of the Jesuit University will decide on Monday, that's today, whether to remove coverage for elective abortions from faculty and staff health care plans. The coming vote has exposed a deep rift over just how Catholic a Catholic university should be in the 21st century and how to maintain that distinctive Catholic identity amid growing diversity on campus. The story gets more interesting as we look at it. First of all, here you have a Jesuit university, a Catholic university, that for the last several years has been paying for abortion coverage for its staff and faculty. Why? Well, the administration has said that it could not find a health policy that would not mandate this kind of coverage. But they now have the opportunity, and the administration has decided to seize that opportunity, and the trustees are expected today to vote to take it. That is, to affirm the fact that the university will be changing its health insurance plan for faculty and staff so that it will no longer include abortion coverage. That's where the situation gets volatile on the campus. Religiously conservative professors and alumni argue, as Levitt says, that as the proportion of Catholics on the campus and the student body and on the faculty has fallen, and it has in recent years, the university has lost touch with its Catholic identity. And thus, these conservative Catholics have been leaning on the university, its president, and its trustees to establish a more prominent role for Catholic doctrine and Catholic practice at the university. And that begins, they argue, with eliminating insurance coverage for abortions. On the other side, you have faculty members who are staging protests about the likely trustee decision. You have faculty members who say this is a violation of academic freedom and the way a major modern university or college should operate. As Levitt summarizes, both sides have come to view today's vote as symbolic of a battle for the university's soul. Lori Levinson's a professor in the law school. She said this, "Loyola Marymount has always represented tolerance, diversity, and a welcoming atmosphere where we can exchange ideas openly." She said, "If this, that means this vote, represents a shift in what it means for Loyola to be a Catholic university, and being a Catholic university now means exclusion, I think Loyola would lose something very special. It would or could dramatically change who's attracted to the university and what faculty members come to teach there as well." On the other side of the faculty and on the other side of this great moral divide is Christopher Kaxer. He's a philosophy professor, and he says it's simply wrong as a matter of justice that Loyola University would pay for abortion coverage. After all, as he says, quote, "part of the university's mission is to promote justice, and in the Catholic tradition, abortion is considered a justice issue. So to say the university supports justice and then also pay for abortions is a contradiction," end quote. Well, as you can see, this is a really interesting development. But it just gets more interesting. As Levitt writes, across the country, the percentage of faculty members who are Catholic has been dropping for years as nearly a third of Americans raised Catholic left the church, prompting some colleges to aggressively recruit Catholic professors. There are still some very Catholic universities, including Boston College and Notre Dame. There, about 70% of the student body is made up of Roman Catholic students. But at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles, only about half of incoming freshmen identify themselves as Catholic, and all that means is that they identify themselves as Catholic. It doesn't mean that they're committed to Catholic doctrine or to the Catholic tradition. Students said there were few reminders that they attended a Catholic university on the campus at all, aside from the fact that at the center of the campus is a glistening white church, and there's the occasional cross on a classroom wall. Let me just interject here to say that if students can't tell it's a Catholic university, then in substance, it's not a Catholic university. And if all being a Catholic university means is having a chapel building in the center and some crosses on the wall, then Loyola Marymount shouldn't be surprised that it has this divide on its own faculty. But the situation just grows more puzzling when the president of the university speaks. When a president speaks in this context, he should clarify. But in this case, this president just adds more confusion to the picture. Why? Well, in the first place, he's a Presbyterian, the first non-Catholic to serve as president of a Jesuit institution. So here you have a university that's supposedly Catholic, but not very Catholic anymore, and the president of the university, a Jesuit university at that, is a Presbyterian who might not be much of a Presbyterian. So what statement did the president's office release? Well, here's part of it. Quote, "faculty and staff have and will continue to have the right to express their strongly held beliefs and principles and to pursue their scholarship wherever it may lead them. Our commitment to academic freedom is at the very heart of what we do at Loyola Marymount University," end quote. So, in other words, what does this Catholic university really worship, and its Presbyterian president as well? The bottom line in terms of the supreme thing valued in this statement is academic freedom. And what does academic freedom mean at Loyola Marymount University? Well, it means the right, evidently, directly to contradict Catholic teaching. So here you have a Catholic university, or one that calls itself Catholic, to which Catholic parents are presumably sending at least some Catholic kids who think it's Catholic, and the students arrive on campus to be greeted by a Presbyterian president and by a faculty divided on an issue that is very clear in Catholic doctrine, with some of the faculty members supporting the Catholic doctrine and others very publicly opposing it. My point in drawing attention to this story isn't to make it a Catholic issue. This is a Catholic issue, but the big picture is not just a Catholic issue. This is how Protestants and evangelicals have lost our institutions as well. It began with the same kind of pressure. It begins with the same kind of idolatrous commitment to academic freedom. In a Christian institution, academic freedom cannot become a license to deny basic truths of the Christian faith. It cannot become a means of avoiding accountability to the churches who establish the school and feed it and fund it. It can't be a way of hiding behind a supposed theological identity when something very different is what's actually taught in the classroom. Just a few years ago, it was a Catholic administrator and professor at a Catholic institution, the University of Notre Dame, that wrote a very important book entitled The Dying of the Light on the disengagement of Protestant college and universities from their churches. That book was absolutely prophetic as he looked at universities, including Vanderbilt, that had been established by Christian churches but had since completely secularized their campuses. And some of the same patterns began to be evident. You had an increase in the number of students coming who were not themselves Christians. And then you had an increase in the number of faculty hired who were not Christians. And then you had administrators hired who were not committed to the truths upon which the university had been established. And then you had the faculty make very clear that its supreme allegiance was to academic freedom, not to the truth that had been affirmed by the church that established the university. What we have here is a head-on collision between the secular expectations of the secular academy and the rightful expectations of a church about a school that it establishes and then funds and continues to support. These kinds of issues have divided many Protestant and indeed some evangelical institutions. It's interesting to see it divide a Catholic institution on this issue. Evidently, one way or another, we're going to find out today just how Catholic Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles intends to be. But then again, you have to wonder if even this change is actually going to reach where the students are in the university, where, so many of the students say, the university doesn't appear to be very Catholic at all. It's got a chapel and some crosses on the wall. That's about it. Sad to say, there are many Protestant institutions that are that secularized and worse. In many cases, these schools have turned to be absolutely antagonistic to the churches and to the doctrines upon which they were established. Just a few weeks ago, we talked about the release of a scientific report telling us that children with bedtimes, fixed bedtimes, do better in school than children that had no fixed bedtime. Did parents really need a news story for that? Well, evidently some did. And evidently some parents need a study that was just reported on in the Wall Street Journal in recent days. Ann Lukacs reports, here's the headline, The Data on Teen Dating Problem After Starting Early. The bottom line in this research, and by the way, it's going to be published in the December issue of the Journal of Adolescence, is that teenagers who start dating really, really early run into trouble, have a very high risk of developing behavioral problems, school problems, and many other things. Let me just read to you from the article. Lukacs reports, boys and girls who start dating at a young age are disrupting the typical pattern of teenage romantic development and may have more school and behavioral problems than their peers. Interest in the opposite sex, she says, usually begins at puberty and gradually evolves into casual interactions followed by group-based dating by the mid-teens. Exclusive one-on-one dating relationships are mostly coming later in adolescence. Now, that's supposedly the normal pattern. And by the way, there are problems with that pattern. But this study really isn't about that pattern, even though it has its own problems. It's about the pattern of children beginning to date really, really early. And the end result of that turns out to be some really, really big problems. Here's how Lukacs explains it. Entering into intimate relationships too early can leave teens ill-prepared to handle typical problems couples face, and without the support of peers at the same stage of development. The experiences can increase the risk of unsafe sexual activity. Remember the fact that the word unsafe here is supposed to make sense. Alcohol use and delinquent behaviors. Late starting daters, on the other hand, that is teenagers who date late rather than early, they may be out of step with their peers, but they have no apparent social or emotional difficulties. We'll go figure that. This particular study indicates that an increasing number of children are beginning to date, that is, right, date, develop romantic relationships with someone of the opposite sex at the age of 11.8. That's before 12 years of age. This early starting group began dating at the age of 11.6. According to this study, again, it's going to be published in the December issue of the Journal of Adolescence, 55% of all teenagers are on time, according to this expectation, in terms of developing romantic relationships. Some are late, but about 20% are really early, and that's where many of these dangers are accentuated. Oh, and by the way, there's the typical disclaimer at the end of the study. You're going to love this one. Quote, teens may have over or underreported their romantic involvement. The findings may also apply only to urban or heterosexual teens in Western countries. End quote. I guess we needed to know that. But what parent with any common sense doesn't know that under the age of 12, or for that matter, anywhere around the age of 12, or for that matter, considerably above the age of 12, is way too early for anything called dating. Christian parents have to press back against this dating culture, and they have to press back hard. It's hard enough, however, when you're pressing back on teenagers in the middle or late teens, much less what we're talking about here, kids who aren't even teenagers yet. Should we be at all surprised that the sexualization of our culture, the romantic expectations, have now been downloaded into children before they even reach puberty? We're talking about a very sick society here, but we're also talking about parents who evidently are more a part of the problem than the solution. Remember that kids these ages can't date by themselves. They can't even go anywhere by themselves, and they're supposed to be supervised at all times. It's really sad that some parents, especially some moms, according to this kind of research, think it's cute that their kids at these ages begin to develop romantic attachments. It's not cute. It's dangerous, and it is not healthy. And if you need a scientific study to assure you of that, well, evidently you need to get the December issue of the Journal of Adolescence. A somewhat related story recently appeared in the New York Times. The headline of this story is, City Unveils a Campaign to Improve Girls' Self-Esteem. Amenia Hartikolis reports for the New York Times, the fashion industry and Madison Avenue are not anathema to Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg in the same way that soda companies and big tobacco are, but they are, in a sense, the impetus for City Hall's latest public health campaign. Now, the mayor of New York, about to finish his term, is often described as a nanny mayor because he has tried to micromanage the decisions of New Yorkers about issues not only related to smoking and other things, but right down to the size of the sodas they would be able to buy. He was rebuffed in that, by the way, by a court, but he tried, and he did push through a regulation saying that it would be actually illegal to sell large capacity soft drinks in the city of New York. Now he's taking on the popular, unattainable notions of beauty promoted by professional image makers with a campaign that tells girls, especially preteen and teenage girls, that they are beautiful the way they are. Well, in this case, I'm with the mayor. This is a very healthy message. This is the kind of messaging that someone really concerned about young people, and especially young girls, should be getting across. Every young girl is beautiful in her way. And when you're talking about New York, you're talking about the capital, at least in terms of fashion advertising, of the kind of messaging young girls are getting. You add that to the Los Angeles basin, Hollywood and Beverly Hills and all the rest, and you're looking at a bipolar picture in a country of messaging being sent to young girls that they have to look a certain way, highly sexualized, highly mature, very beautiful by contemporary secular standards, or they're just not worthy of someone's attention. It's going to be bus and subway advertising that runs this campaign. It is aiming to reach girls from about 7 to 12 years old who are at risk of negative body images that can lead to all kinds of negative consequences. The city is spending $330,000 on it. It's called the NYC Girls Project. And the girls who are featured in these posters are actually the daughters of city employees. Just normal girls from normal families being presented in a normal way. The first ad features Devore Wigfall, a robust, laughing 12-year-old from University Heights in the Bronx. She says on the photograph, I'm a girl, I'm funny, playful, daring, strong, curious, smart, brave, healthy, friendly, and caring. I'm beautiful the way I am. The Paley Center for Media in New York City, in partnership with the city and the SPARK movement, which works against the sexualization of women in media, developed related programs that look at the representation of girls on television. Well, as I say, I'm with the mayor on this one. I think this is the kind of messaging we should all be sending to young girls, and for that matter, to women of all ages as well. Each girl and woman is beautiful in her own way, and these artificial understandings of beauty are nothing less than sin, and they are having a horrible effect upon women of all ages. But as much as I'm with the mayor on this one, I have to say he's outgunned. He's outgunned by Madison Avenue. He's outgunned by the fashion industry, and he is way outgunned by Hollywood and the entertainment industry. When it comes to pressing back on this artificial and altogether unhealthy understanding of beauty, we have to say to the mayor, go for it. But, Your Honor, you better know what you're up against. Because in this case, you and women of all ages are outgunned by the larger culture. It's going to take a lot more than posters on subways and buses to counter that kind of influence. But you know what? It really could be powerful if it started at home, if it was affirmed in the church, and if every young man, beginning with Christian young men, understood to look for true beauty and to honor it wherever it's found. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.